The first case for argument this morning is appeal number 064178, Consolidated Industries v. Innotus Corporation. Mr. Handler.
May it please the court, I'm going to focus on four key legal errors that led to the judgment below. I'll first summarize all four, and then I'll go through each one in some detail. Here are the four. First and foremost, the lower courts misinterpreted the dividend notes, and the interpretation of the dividend notes was the key issue below, the key issue that impacted everything below. Secondly, the lower courts did not properly apply the Covey and Zonix test in valuing contingent liabilities and then compounded that error by using impermissible hindsight in valuing contingent liabilities. Third, the lower courts had a fundamental misconception about the legal rights of the owner of a business to use cash from that business to pay its own corporate debts. And finally, the lower court, the district court, violated Rule 56 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in weighing evidence on a motion for summary judgment. Let me go to my first point, which is the dividend notes. The district court acknowledged that the dividend notes were the key issue in solvency. What I'd like to put up on the easel key language from the dividend notes, critical from the dividend notes. Each of these dividend notes, at the end of the first paragraph, is the final sentence, and it says the principal of this note represents the payment of a dividend declared by the maker's board of directors, and therefore is payable only out of funds legally available for the payment of a dividend.
Well, that just restates the corporation law, doesn't it?
Exactly. And the point of it is that under Indiana law, in most states, you can't pay a dividend if the paying of the dividend would render the company insolvent. The interpretation of this contract language and the statutes, the corporate statutes, that's a matter of law. The language here is unambiguous. And under this language, from Consolidated's perspective, and in the Covey case, this court said, in valuing liabilities, you have to do this from the debtor's perspective, the debtor being Consolidated. From the debtor's perspective, given this language, the dividend notes could never render Consolidated insolvent because the principal of this note, no part of the principal of this note could be paid if it rendered the company insolvent.
But, counsel, that legal language doesn't insulate the millions of dollars in interest payments that were paid over the course of the intervening
Correct.
Years
Yeah.
from evaluation or from being factored into
Yes.
the evaluation of insolvency.
Yep. You're absolutely right. But what the courts below did in their opinion was that they said basically, When the notes were issued, early 1989 for retroactive to 1988, and in 1989, that $30 million at that time rendered the company insolvent. We're not saying the interest payments. That's a totally different issue, which the courts below never reached.
Right. What did the expert witnesses say about that?
Our experts, their experts said, Mr. Allerdink said, as soon as these notes were issued, he put a negative $30 million as the fair value of this liability on the balance sheet and said, from that point forward, Consolidated was insolvent. Our experts said, nope, we can't do that because of this language.
Weren't there two plaintiffs' experts on solvency?
They had a, if I'm pronouncing his name, Mr. Lee, I guess, like Fleur de Lee, but he wasn't the necessarily the solvency expert, he had a different aspect of the solvency question.
Did the other expert, Alderis?
Allerding.
Allerding, did he state his solvency conclusions alternatively? In other words, did he state a conclusion about solvency based on the interest payments?
He made a distinction, which we make in our group. He said, after 1992, in other words, prior to the implications, prior to 1993, you need the dividend notes to render it insolvent. After January 1, 1993, he said, if you forget about contingent liabilities, forget about the dividend notes, and you use certain book values, then Consolidated was insolvent. That's why we made a distinction in our brief, saying there was no evidence, once you interpret this correctly, there was no evidence that would have been sufficient to render Consolidated insolvent prior to January 1, 1993. And after January 1, 1993, because there were legal errors that occurred, you need to remand the case to have that analyzed under the proper
Seems to
rules.
Me that that's a pretty circular proposition, isn't it, that you're attempting to persuade us of?
I'm sorry.
It's a circular argument that you're making, it seems to me. You're saying that if you pay this money, that renders the company insolvent, and therefore that you don't have an obligation to pay the money. It seems to me there's a circularity involved.
I respectfully disagree, because I think this does not go to an obligation to this doesn't go to ability to pay. This goes to whether Consolidated had a legal duty to pay. And on its face, there was no legal duty for Consolidated to pay any part of the principal when it became due in 10 years that would have rendered the company insolvent. In fact, it would have been prohibited from doing that because under the combination of this and Indiana law. It couldn't do that, could not make that payment. And what we're saying is that the courts below erred on
Well, this the attachment of this language to the note has nothing to do with the outcome, though, did it? I mean, that's part of the corporation law of Indiana. So
well,
what difference does it make whether you put it on the
because
note?
Because it makes the note subject to the same rules that would govern a dividend. In other words, if it wasn't in the note, someone could argue, well, this is a note, not a dividend, therefore it isn't subject to this. What this language does is it says this is subject to exactly the same rules as a dividend.
It says it is a dividend. Represents the payment of a dividend.
That's right.
It doesn't say it's treated like a dividend. It says it is a dividend.
That's correct.
Okay. If it is a dividend, the note doesn't have to say it should be treated as a dividend. But go ahead.
Okay. So what did the lower courts do with this language below? They never discuss it. They didn't do anything with it. They didn't attempt to reconcile their decision with this language. And I submit to you, there is no way to reconcile their decision with this language. And this is a legal matter, the interpretation of this note. The courts below got it wrong. And
Counsel, solvency is a factual determination. And I understand there's a question about the methodology that was used to determine solvency and whether the district courts employed the appropriate legal methodology to get to that conclusion. But it is fundamentally a factual determination. It seems to me the fight about how these notes should be interpreted begs the question about whether the subsequent interest payments over the course of the intervening years, which were paid pursuant to these dividend notes, ultimately rendered the corporation insolvent. And that's what my questions were intended to get at, although there weren't detailed findings by the district court or the bankruptcy court on that subject, was there sufficient evidence in the record to sustain on that alternative interpretation?
Right. And that's why we say, because they only argued that. They only argued the interest payments by themselves made it insolvent from 1993 on. They didn't make that argument prior to 1993. So it isn't a factual issue prior to...
We don't have any expert testimony about insolvency based on the interest payments prior to 1993.
On the interest payments alone, we do not.
From either side? Or did your expert say...
No, we just have... Where they were arguing was January 1993 on...
What was this company worth when Innotus was acquired by Kohlberg? Right, is the leverage buyout, the original leverage buyout?
Well, this consolidated wasn't acquired by Kohlberg. Innotus was, the ultimate parent was.
Right, and there is no evidence in the record about what consolidated the subsidiary, which is the debtor here.
There is. Mr. Allerding had... if I remember the figures from his expert report is in the appendix. He said it was worth something like, if I remember, $17 or $18 million on a book value basis.
No fair value estimation?
I think he equated book value and fair value, which is another issue, but... I think where he was saying on a book value basis worth $17 to $18 million, something in that range, and the $20 million, the first dividend note, rendered it insolvent in and of itself. The principal amount, nothing, not interest, the principal amount.
And then what was it worth 10 years later in 1998 when it was spun off to, I can't remember the name of the ultimate buyer.
To Mr. Hall?
Yes.
Yeah, that goes into how you value the contingent liabilities. If you look at Mr. Allerding's report, and we think the number's higher, but he said if you take a best case view of the contingent liabilities, it was valued at, I believe, the shareholders' equity was something like $2.7 million. We think it was more in the neighborhood of $11 million if you just compare what the assets were on certain documents we introduced into evidence and the value of the liabilities. But even he, if you take his best case in his report, shows consolidated being solvent as of early 1998, but he, of course, says that's not the case you should use. You should use something like the worst case, in which he uses to then say it's insolvent.
Well, it's in bankruptcy 4 months later, after the Hall transaction.
Pardon?
The company is in bankruptcy 4 months after the Hall transaction.
It filed 4 months later. Absolutely.
Hall put up nothing for this leverage buyout. It was entirely financed by the assets of the corporation.
It was, say, it's financed as a leverage buyout. And it was a $7 million purchase price for the stock.
But that's unusual for a buyer in this situation to put up nothing, is it not?
I can't comment whether it is.
There wasn't any testimony about that one way or the other?
Is, or I honestly don't recall. So if once you value the contingent liabilities correctly, dividend notes correctly, then you're thrown onto contingent liabilities because the trustee's insolvency case, to the extent it exists at all, has to exist based on contingent liabilities. And I don't know if you have the original brief that we filed, which has the bankruptcy court opinion attached to it at page 38 of the short appendix. But it's clear that in valuing contingent liabilities, the bankruptcy court and the district court used impermissible hindsight analysis. In other words, information that was available years later to find that there were large contingent liabilities. The only dollar figure that was mentioned is cited from a document, Plaintiff's Exhibit 575, which is a 2002 SEC filing by Innotus PLC, my client's ultimate parent corporation. It has nothing to do with earlier times. It certainly has nothing to do with 1989, 1992. The only year mentioned is 1995, and there is no listing of what the claims against Consolidated were then and what discount was applied to it. And there was, and the transfers here, including the interest transfers, Judge Sykes, that you mentioned, covered a 9-year period from the beginning of 1989 through the end of 1997. At no time during that period did the courts below use contemporaneous documents to value the amount of the liabilities and apply a discount to it. And they certainly didn't do it prior to 1993, when the situation that Consolidated faced was different than it was after that time, when there was no Consumer Product Safety Commission inquiry, when there was no SALIC class action litigation.
Did any of the experts engage in an appropriate discounting of those contingent liabilities, the lawsuits and the class action in California and the CPSC investigation?
Well, interestingly, Allerdeen did come up with some figures, but the bankruptcy court really dismissed his testimony on that, and that's, I believe, at volume 3, page 217 of the transcript, where the bankruptcy court said Allerdeen's just a numbers guy. He's just putting down there what other people, principally Mr. Weber, former president, had said, and that his testimony doesn't stand. He's not qualified to give an independent opinion as to contingent liabilities. So there really wasn't expert testimony that on that issue. There was a lot of testimony as to the liabilities, but not from an expert point that the bankruptcy court accepted.
Doesn't make any difference unless you're right about this point, though, isn't it, right?
Nothing makes a difference unless I'm right about this point.
Okay.
I mean, it makes a difference on the actual fraud counts, but in the terms of solvency, nothing makes a difference unless I'm right on that point. Now, as to actual fraud, the third point I mentioned, the lower courts compounded their errors as to solvency with an error, a fundamental misconception as to the rights of an owner of a business to use money from the business to pay its own corporate debts. Both courts, in discussing actual fraud, said that the real reason cash went from Consolidated to its ultimate parent was to pay the parent's own LBO debt, and they placed a lot of reliance on that. And it's undisputed that Innotus did use cash from all of its 17 or so subsidiaries to pay its own bank debt. But so what? As long as Consolidated was solvent, it had the right to get that money, whether it was by a dividend or a dividend note. Assuming insolvency, there is nothing in the law that governs the speed that money can be upstreamed to an owner, whether by a dividend or a dividend note. Now, there absolutely can be no finding of actual fraud based upon doing something that was legal and proper. Yet, here are the courts, lower courts, in essence, did that.
Well, you're saying that the question of actual fraud depends on the solvency, then, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, I am, because...
So we're getting back to the dividends.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, although I do not think that's dispositive of it, of the actual fraud finding. So here, the lower courts held that Consolidated committed actual frauds because payments of these dividend notes and not the principal, because that was never paid, but interest payments on the dividend notes, was used to pay the corporate debts of Unotus. Now, the fourth legal error relates to the weighing of evidence on a summary judgment motion. There were cross motions for summary judgment below on the Hall transaction. And I see my time for original time. I'm going to stop now. I think that issue is covered in our brief, and we'll save our remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Diggie.
May it please the Court. I think Your Honor's questions hit the nail on the head. The reasoning that Wellbuilt uses in this appeal is very circular. Their entire argument, they've just admitted, hinges upon this Court concluding that dividend notes, which the bankruptcy court found Wellbuilt forced Consolidated to issue in amounts that were in excess of the value of its assets, shouldn't be counted as real liabilities on Consolidated's financial statements, even though Wellbuilt directed them to record those liabilities as real liabilities. They treated the liabilities as real liabilities. They pledged the notes to Wellbuilt's bank group as collateral. They had default provisions within them. They accounted for them for tax purposes, as the bankruptcy court found, as if they were real liabilities. And most importantly, they took over $30 million of Consolidated's assets based upon these notes that they now want to pretend didn't exist. And what Wellbuilt is really trying to do here with this circular reasoning is the proverbial have your cake and eat it too. Let's pretend for insolvency purposes that these notes don't count, but let us keep all of the interest payments we took on notes that we now contend were conditional and never came into existence. But if you engage in that logic, and you in fact find that these notes did not exist, then on what basis did Wellbuilt take all of the payments under the notes? There was no legal justification for taking that money. And so the bankruptcy court's ruling was still correct. One could view that as unjust enrichment, just the simple taking of cash for no apparent reason. One could view it as an actual fraudulent transfer, and I would disagree with counsel. Under the case law that is developed under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act in Indiana and elsewhere, the court weighs the badges of fraud. Insolvency can be an indicator of fraud, but it doesn't have to exist to find an actual fraudulent transfer. One can view it as an improper undeclared dividend because they didn't actually declare the dividend, and that applies to the $6.9 million cash payment. The end of the day is, if you don't count these notes for insolvency purposes, the court's ruling was still correct and the funds ought to be returned. To address the court's questions, though, about what the expert testimony was about with insolvency, the court clearly did apply the correct legal standards set forth by this court in the Covey decision and the Zonix decision and the other decisions which deal with how one measures insolvency. Mr. Allerding and Professor Lees, who were the only two parties to testify as to asset values, both testified that the values that were stated on Consolidated's reported financial statements that were in evidence, the book values, were fair indicators of what the fair market value was. And why, how did they get there? Well, one reason why they got there was is in December of 1988, in connection with the Wellbuilt leverage buyout, one of the things that Wellbuilt's accountants, Arthur Anderson, did was they restated all of the internal financial statements for all of the subsidiaries, including Consolidated, using purchase method accounting. And purchase method accounting states asset values at their fair value, and everyone agreed to that. Mr. Allerding testified to that. Keith Gardner, the defendant's expert, testified that that was the case. The various accountants who were fact witnesses testified, Clevin Clamera. Everyone agrees purchase accounting increases asset value to fair value. So the opening balance sheet for the time period that we're talking about here was presumably stated by Arthur Anderson at fair value. Mr. Allerding, who was an appraiser who had 30-plus years of experience appraising businesses, testified that this type of business, basically a metal-bending type business, that typically speaking, its asset values wouldn't be any greater on a going concern basis than its book values. Professor Lees, an economist, sampled a variety of companies that were industrial metal-bending type companies like Consolidated that went into bankruptcy in the late 90s and then compared back to the time period that we're talking about as to how the market value for the stock of those entities compared to the book value of the assets. And he determined that on average, the market value was approximately 90% of what was listed in the book value, and the median was approximately 80%. So that would suggest that Mr. Allerding's testimony, Professor Lee's testimony, that you would use the book value to approximate fair value was actually very conservative in favor of the defendants and overstated the value. Finally, if that isn't enough, we have two other bits of evidence, two actual sales. One of the largest assets on Consolidated's balance sheet, its real estate, was sold approximately 2 years after the asset was stated for fair market value, and it was sold for $400,000 less than the value that was placed upon it when that asset was written up to what was supposedly its market value. So again, that suggests that these numbers overstated Consolidated's value rather than understated them. And we also see that Welbilt tried to sell this business from 1994 on. It couldn't sell it. On its own internal financial statements during that time period, Welbilt wrote the asset value of Consolidated down to zero. That is an undisputed fact. No one would buy it. When Mr. Hall came in, and the transaction involving Mr. Hall is very unusual. It wasn't even structured the way one might normally properly structure an LBO. They just had Consolidated borrow some money and send it over to Welbilt. And he ended up walking away with the stock. And the evidence shows that after that transaction was done, the accountants couldn't figure out how to book it because it hadn't even been structured appropriately as a leveraged buyout in terms of how it was done. And there wasn't sufficient equity to treat that $7 million as a dividend to Mr. Hall. It wasn't a note because he obviously wasn't agreeing to repay Consolidated, and they had a lot of trouble setting forth the financial statements because they couldn't book it appropriately. All of that was the evidence on asset value. Keith Gardner, defendant's expert, gave no opinion on asset value. With respect to liabilities, from the period of 1989 to 1993, which is the only time the dividend notes matter, because after that point in time, Consolidated is insolvent without adding anything for the dividend notes, and without adding anything for the furnace-related liabilities. There's also abundant testimony that the court could have, had it chosen to, the lower court, quantified those liabilities in an amount that would have made Consolidated insolvent. All it took was $5 million of additional contingent furnace-related liabilities to make Consolidated insolvent during the time period between 1989 and 1992. What the evidence was Mr. Allerding's testimony. Mr. Allerding testified that he quantified those contingent liabilities to be approximately $9.6 million. That would have rendered Consolidated insolvent. Now, counsel tells you, and this is in a footnote in their brief, well, you should ignore that evidence that's highlighted in our brief because Judge Grant wouldn't consider it. He just viewed Mr. Allerding as a Bain counter and didn't view that testimony as credible. He cites to a preliminary ruling before the opinion is given where Mr. Allerding is discussing what documents he reviewed. And counsel objects, and the court basically says, at this point he's just telling us what he looked at. We haven't gotten to what the opinions are. The real issue there as to whether the court credited his opinions or not is found in the next volume.
Are the contingent liabilities really of significance here if you prevail on this dividend point?
No, they don't matter, Your Honor. The only way that they matter is that I think it's also an indicator of actual fraudulent intent, which is how the bankruptcy court viewed
them.
Well,
if we're talking about fraudulent intent, one of the things that I'd like to be enlightened about is the bankruptcy court suggested that secrecy was one of the badges of fraud here. I don't know how these transactions were secret. They were entered on the books of the company. The company was not a public company, so its activities were not on television, but they were recorded on the books. How can you say that that's a secret?
What the evidence was, Candy Moyer testified, and she's at volume 10 of the transcript, that she was instructed by Welbilt that if creditors inquired as to Consolidated's financial circumstances, conditions, as for financial statements, she was instructed not to provide the internal financial statements of Consolidated. She was instructed to provide the publicly filed SEC reports, which did not show this. Mr. Gross, Lawrence Gross, who was on the board during the early time period when these notes were first declared, also testified that that was the instruction that Welbilt gave to Consolidated, that it was not to reveal these internal bookkeeping entries. It was not to provide those financial statements to third parties. So no one could really discover this because anybody who inquired wouldn't be told. And I think also that the bankruptcy court's finding with regard to the secrecy and the nature of the transaction is really beyond just the secrecy. It's also the fact that the transaction is so unusual. They declared a dividend for twice the value of the company. Everyone agreed that they couldn't do that. Even their expert testified that you can't declare a dividend for an amount in excess of the value of the company, and he agreed that Consolidated never had $30 million. That's what our experts testified to. That's what every layperson testified to. And they essentially just violated Indiana corporate law in declaring the dividend and then did what the bankruptcy court, I think, found as a matter of fact, used it as a device to suck cash out of Consolidated at a time when everyone knew that Consolidated was shortly going to be facing fairly significant furnace-related claims.
Was there testimony by the expert witnesses to the effect that if the interest was paid pursuant to the terms of these dividend notes, aside from this legal qualifying language that any such payment must comply with Indiana corporate law, that those payments would render the company insolvent? Assuming that the terms of the note were paid, the interest.
Right. What their expert testified to, Mr. Gardner testified to, it's at page 156, 157 of the transcript. And this is something they say he didn't say, but Your Honors can look at the transcript and you'll see that that's the case he did say it. He basically said you couldn't pay interest on these notes. His testimony wasn't that it was okay to pay interest on these notes. Mr. Gardner's testimony was just pretend it didn't happen and let's pretend we did it some other way. And maybe there might have been a way that they could have done it validly. That was his testimony. He didn't really suggest how they might have done it validly. He just said maybe there was another way to structure it where they might have been able to take some of the money. But as the bankruptcy court said, that's not really what they did. To recast these things and to give it some legitimacy when, in point in fact, what they did was saddle Consolidated with a $30 million liability that they charged an extremely high rate of interest on, used it as a vehicle to take all the cash. The court concluded that that was an actual fraudulent transfer, and it was also a constructive fraudulent transfer because there was no real value given in connection with those interest payments. To the point of insolvency during this 1989 through 1993 time period, in addition to Mr. Allerding's quantification of that liability, which the court ultimately, in volume 4 of the transcript, when he rules on defendant's Daubert motion, finds that he accepts his testimony and denies the Daubert motion and so accepts the $9.6 million conclusion. In addition to that, you have the testimony of Richard Weber, who was the president of Consolidated during this particular time period. And Mr. Weber testified unrebutted that the problems with the warranties were known from the late 1980s. The bankruptcy court makes that finding. Mr. Weber testified that this was a very significant concern. There was a 10-year warranty in connection with these furnaces. There's no insurance to cover warranty claims. It was known at that point in time in 1989 that they had manufactured approximately 800,000 of these furnaces. And they knew because of tests that they were doing internally that these furnaces were defective, and they also knew what it would approximately cost to replace a furnace. So it was known during that time period exactly what the extent of that magnitude of liability would be. Given that this is a company that manufactures consumer products, they clearly knew or should have known that there was a likelihood of consumer product safety recall, that there was a likelihood of class action litigation. These were not concepts that were foreign to them. There's memos in evidence about the parties discussing just that and how they might contain it. Ultimately, in early 1992, they quantify some of these numbers on a piece of paper, but they all understood the magnitude of those numbers, as Mr. Weber testified, throughout this 1989 through 1992 time period. And that's additional evidence that the court could have used to quantify these liabilities. So there's not a lack of evidence to find insolvency, even if you discount the notes. And we would suggest that if the court were to discount the notes, which we don't think would be proper, the thing that would be required to be done would be to remand so that Judge Grant could actually quantify what these furnace-related liabilities are. With respect to how to treat the notes, our position would be, as the bankruptcy judge found, that he found it correctly. What they argued below was not that this was a contract law question. If the court looks at docket number 620 in the bankruptcy court, you will see that they devoted two paragraphs to their argument about how to treat the notes. And what they basically said there was, bankruptcy judge, you should adopt the position taken by the losing party in the court's Covey decision and discount these notes as contingent liabilities that are discounted by the asset value of the corporation. They never developed this contract law argument until they came into this court. But if you look at it as a contract law argument that the notes were somehow conditional, this language here is not conditional language. It just tells you what the law says. What is unconditional about these notes is the promise to pay and the fact that they were a definite promise by Consolidated to pay at that time. The court also looked, the bankruptcy court also looked and devotes much of its opinion to how the parties in fact treated these notes during the time period that they were in existence. And the court notes that the parties themselves treated these notes as real liabilities. There are innumerable memos from Wellbuilt to Consolidated's accounting department found in Plaintiff's Exhibit 79 where they're directing the accounting treatment of interest on these notes, principal on these notes, how to record these on the books. Essentially, Wellbuilt's accounting department was acting as the board of directors here and telling Consolidated how it should show these particular liabilities. They did take tax treatment for it. That's undisputed. That tax treatment that they took caused them problems. There's a memo in Evidence Plaintiff's Exhibit 565 that talks about the tax problems they realized they had had by virtue of what they had done and how they tried to fix that. I mean, these were as real a notes as one could get. And while I think that they included this language, one could say, looking at it, perhaps with an idea that they could point to it if anyone ever challenged what they did, they didn't in fact act as though these weren't valid notes.
Who was directing the payment of interest?
Wellbuilt was. Wellbuilt would send memos every month saying this is how you keep your books and records. I mean, one of the things they say in their reply brief in connection with our alter ego cross appeal is that Wellbuilt kept, Consolidated kept its own books. That is just not true. If the court looks at Plaintiff's Exhibit 79, looks at the testimony of Candy Moyer, Richard Weber, who's President Candy Moyer was the controller. Richard Hutchinson was the president for the time period after Mr. Weber left. All three of those individuals testified. They didn't have any discretion on how to keep the books. Wellbuilt told them exactly how to make every single accounting entry that related to these important issues, oversaw the budgets, oversaw everything with respect to the finances of this company, kept it on a very short lease because, as I think the bankruptcy court found, they wanted to suck as much money as possible out of it, and they didn't want the parties that Consolidated interfering with that, so they directed them as to how it was they were to keep the books.
So there isn't any evidence that Consolidated itself, its executives, was doing the legal analysis called for by this conditional language on the notes before paying the interest?
No, there's no evidence of that. In fact, Mr. Weber testified. He was the president at the time. He hadn't even seen the notes until he was shown them at trial. He was never shown them. He said, as far as he knew, no lawyer ever looked at them. He just got a memo in the middle of February saying, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And as he testified, when Wellbuilt told you what to do, you did it. And if you didn't do it, you anticipated that you would be fired. Every time, for example, dealing with the contingent liabilities that they claim no one knew about, there was testimony from Mr. Weber that when he raised issues about the liabilities at meetings at the corporate office, he was told to keep quiet and quit talking about it. In memos, there's a memo that's in evidence that was testified to Mr. Yee, who received it by Mr. Weber at volume 22 of the transcript, where he basically attaches with the warranty analysis the thing saying, I'm not talking about this dot, dot, dot due to legal problems. I mean, there's ample evidence that parties didn't want to talk about it. Mr. Hutchinson, when he came on board, he had been at the safety committee at Carrier. He was floored to see that there had been 40 fires. Carrier manufactures as many furnaces in a year as Consolidated manufactured in that 1 year period. And he testified no line that he was aware of ever had more than two fires caused by faulty defects in the furnace. He went immediately to say, what are we going to do about this? This is really a big problem. And he was told, we're not talking about it. He said, it can't be installation error. And he was told by Mr. Antonini, it's installation error. That's it. Don't talk about it. We don't want you to say anything about it. When the one lawyer Consolidated had that basically did some shuffling of papers back and forth with Wellbuilt's lawyers, Jerry Witherid, actually told someone who was looking to buy the company about the extent of the liabilities, he was fired and taken off the case and wasn't allowed to do any more work for Consolidated, what minimal work that he did do. So there's ample evidence that there was an effort not to talk about these liabilities, conceal them, take money out while everyone knew they were coming with the hope that they could get their money out before the creditors did. And that's essentially what Professor Lees testified to, that this device of declaring dividends in excess of asset value was so unusual that he said there were six instances out of 18,000 corporations where it had ever even approached before, that you could only conclude that it was structured with an idea that the equity would be able to get its money out before the creditors realized what was occurring.
What about the timing issue? The original leveraged buyout was followed, I think, within a year by the first dividend note declaration. Is that right?
The leveraged buyout took place in the summer-fall of 1988. The notes were directed to be issued in February of 89. And when they directed the issuance of those notes, what they did is they went back and they said, collect interest, in other words, give us the right to take cash of approximately $900,000 for the time period from September of 1988 through that February date. So they went back and they charged interest for time periods when the notes weren't even in effect. And that corresponds with when essentially the leverage buyout occurred. With respect to the other issues on appeal, with respect to our cross appeal, the reason why
I'd like to ask you a question about the Hall transaction, which and Judge Sharp's opinion, which he withdrew the reference on that matter. But he seemed to me to be saying that the defendant's evidence is less credible than the trustee's. Now, that's not an appropriate approach to summary judgment, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I think with respect to the insolvency finding, I think that the record before Judge Sharp at that time were the fact that Hall paid nothing for the company. So you had evidence that there was nothing paid for the assets, which would suggest that they had no fair market value. They were urging this draft balance sheet, but what was in the record about that draft balance sheet that we had included in the record in our response to that was the deposition testimony from Kevin Clamera. And Mr. Clamera testified that he couldn't finish the balance sheet because of the substantial nature of the liabilities.
Well, you're just saying your evidence was better than their evidence, and the judge seemed to go along with that, but I don't think that's an appropriate way to handle a summary judgment.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it's really more than that. I mean, what they were saying about this draft balance sheet, in light of the testimony that it wasn't finished, I don't know that the court was really required to give it any weight, because it wasn't a completed document. It wouldn't necessarily have been admissible into evidence had you gone to trial to show much of anything, because the author of it said he hadn't completed the work to finish it. So to suggest that that shows solvency when the party who's preparing the document hadn't completed it, it was appropriate for Judge Sharp not to include that. And ultimately, at the end of the day, when Mr. Clamera did testify to it in the bankruptcy court, he testified that Consolidated was insolvent. That would have been his conclusion, and he would have qualified the company as a going concern. So I'm not sure what remand for a trial really does.
The other experts obviously backed that up, since they pegged insolvency at a much earlier date.
That's right. And in addition, also before the court was an excerpt from their expert's deposition testimony, where he said Consolidated didn't have any equity. In talking about this problem about how to treat Mr. Hall, he basically said, well, no one could treat the $7 million as a dividend to Mr. Hall, the classic way you might structure an LBO, because Consolidated didn't have equity to issue a $7 million dividend. So he also had basically an admission from their expert that there was no value there. So I think that while normally one views insolvency as a fact issue, given the record that was presented to him by the defendants and what was there, I don't think that they did anything to raise a material issue of fact.
And the summary judgment determination is really subsumed in the ultimate findings that the courts below made on solvency.
I think that's right. I mean, here you have an unusual circumstance where you essentially have a trial after a summary judgment ruling, and that trial, I think, shows overwhelmingly that for that time period Judge Sharp was considering, there wasn't any evidence that Consolidated was solvent. Their expert, Mr. Gardner, said, I will accept Kevin Clamera's conclusions. Kevin Clamera then is called by them, and he testifies the company was insolvent. As to the other issue they raised, reasonably equivalent value, I would really urge the court to go back and look at their summary judgment briefs. They did not raise the issue as it's raised in this court there, and it really isn't appropriately in front of the court on appeal on their question about collapsing everything. Again, this is another one where either way they go, they don't get to where they want, which is a reversal of the court's ruling. They argue in their opening brief that the court should have viewed the payment to them as a payment of the IDB debt because they had guaranteed the IDB debt. But under this court's various decisions, DiPrezio and the like, that guarantee that Welbilt had made of Consolidated's obligations to the Tippecanoe County on the bond debt created a contingent claim. So if you collapse it and view it as a payment of a debt, then it was just a classic preference. It was a payment on account of an antecedent debt made within the time period for an insider when Consolidated was insolvent and other unsecured creditors weren't going to get paid. In their reply brief, they changed that argument around, and they say that they think it should be viewed as a payment of Mr. Hall's obligations. But if it's a payment, if it's Consolidated's assets being used to allow someone to acquire its stock, then Judge Sharp's characterization of the transaction was correct, and that's a classic leverage buyout. And was upset, was capable of being upset because Consolidated was insolvent at the time.
Now your cross appeal.
The cross appeal. With respect to the alter ego claim, the only issue that Judge Grant addressed was the question of whether or not, under Indiana law, a corporation can sue its former owner or sue its owner to pierce the corporate veil or for alter ego liability, or whether or not we had some rights under Section 544A to stand in the shoes of creditors and do so. He concluded, we contend erroneously, based on this court's Koch refining decision, that the trustee couldn't bring that cause of action because in Indiana a corporation can't sue to pierce its own corporate veil. Judge Sharp reversed, acknowledging that this court's Koch refining decision was controlling until the Indiana Supreme Court ruled, and this court has said that an Indiana corporation can pierce its own corporate veil. On appeal, the defendants do not challenge that conclusion. They don't contest that. Instead, they say, well, there was a ruling on the merits. In the bankruptcy court opinion, there clearly was no ruling on the merits. The judge very clearly headlines each count as he's addressing it, entitling that account, and one can see he doesn't address the merits because he didn't have to, because he concluded legally we couldn't bring the claim. In the district court, there is some language by Judge Sharp that might suggest that he was ruling on the merits, but there, that's deficient because he doesn't explain how it is he gets there. He purports to be adopting what the bankruptcy court said, but the bankruptcy court never really addressed the merits. So I think that this on that particular issue, which is important because the claims filed against the estate exceed the amounts that have been taken fraudulently from Consolidated. So there is a need for additional recovery to redress the wrongs caused by Welbilt. There should be a remand so that the bankruptcy court can actually address the merits of the alter ego claim and make the appropriate findings whether the trustee prevails on that claim. We would submit that if the district court's ruling actually was a ruling on the merits, that ruling was clearly erroneous, and it is in conflict with every other finding they made in connection with the fraudulent transfers. The court found that there was commingling of cash. The court found that there was a lack of corporate formalities and appropriate following of corporate procedures, and there was much more additional evidence that we outline in our brief about that issue.
But that claim, that alter ego veil-piercing claim, is not an independent basis of liability. It's just a way of getting at Welbilt Holding, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a way to make them liable. The court found that it's a cause of action that we could pursue, and it's a way to make them make redress to the creditors of Consolidated.
To give you a different source of funding the judgment, right? You can't recover twice.
No, the court found that it was an independent, and they never really, they did make some challenges about that in the lower court, but they've not pursued that on appeal. He found that that was a basis, an independent basis for liability.
For what sums? The same judgment that is covered by the recovery against Welbilt?
No. What the amount of the judgment would be, what the court had stated he would have done had it gotten to liability, is it would have determined after recovery of the fraudulent transfers and whatever other assets are in the estate, of which there was none because basically everything had been taken by the time the trustee was appointed, that what the deficiency was in the estate, that would be what would be the amount of the alter ego judgment, so that they would have to make the estate to the point where it was whole and all creditors were paid.
Over and above what's recovered from Welbilt on the fraudulent transfer claims.
Yes,
sure.
Unless the court has any other questions, we would. Our time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. As I heard Ms. Stege's, she said that the argument that we're making here was not made below. Let me just read you briefly from the our post-trial brief in the bankruptcy court. This is on page 82. Accordingly, under the terms of the dividend notes, payment of principal cannot be made if the payment would render consolidated insolvent. The fair value of the restricted liability was necessarily less than an amount that would have rendered consolidated insolvent. That is exactly the argument that we've made on this appeal, almost word for word. And we made that same argument in the district court and cited that to you at page 8 of our reply brief. Now, in considering this issue, remember, the dividend notes were issued on the advice of accountants, on the advice of lawyers. We've cited to you tax court cases where these are viewed as proper devices. They've admitted that they're proper devices in their brief. The issue, simply, as we said before, how can this language be reconciled with the solvency determination? How can this language, under this language, can there be $30 million that their experts put on their solvency balance sheets at fair value to try and find that this company is insolvent? It's absolutely impossible that that can be the fair value in light of this language. It is not true, as Ms. Stege said, that everybody agreed with their analysis. She's citing Mr. Gardner, and we responded to that in footnote 1 of our reply brief. On the actual fraud point that was raised, there's no evidence that anyone asked for specific information and that anyone stonewalled them on that specific information. There simply is no duty for every private company in America to broadcast their internal financials. And yet that was one of the legal errors that the district court in the bankruptcy court had in making a finding of actual fraud. Ms. Stege said the issue wasn't what the issue talked about what the court could do on contingent liabilities, talked about this piece of evidence, that piece of evidence. The thing she didn't respond to, and the thing that's the legal error, is that the courts below didn't correctly apply the Covey and Zonick standard. And there was a lot of contrary evidence. If they didn't apply the correct legal standard, then that's reversible error. That's not something that was solvent. Ms. Stege claimed that this company is just pulling money out of Consolidated. My client in notice posted a $7 million letter of credit to secure the Tippecanoe County loan for Consolidated. That's not just taking money one way. $7 million letter of credit. And there's absolutely the weighing of evidence on the summary judgment motion. There's no way. All these arguments, that is not harmless error. There was a clear weighing of evidence which was improper. Let me make 2 points on the cross appeal. We cited in our response to their cross appeal this court's decision in the Papa versus Katie Industries case, and we quoted it. They had no response to it in their reply. And this court said there, which could apply directly to what's going on here, the plaintiffs seem to think that unless a corporate group erects a Chinese wall between affiliates, each affiliate is responsible for the other's debt. That is nonsense. Those are the words of this court. And we cited to you lots of evidence that Consolidated, there wasn't any evidence that any creditor of Consolidated was confused as to who was going to be responsible. Of course, they were all paid over a 10-year period. But there was no confusion here. Consolidated was the extent of control in the Katie Industries case was greater than what what was done here. There is absolutely no basis to pierce the corporate veil. And, of course, in the district court, they said the district court reviewed the issue de novo. On the well-built holding, I don't want to sound excessively paranoid. I'm paranoid by nature, but they're doing a strange thing here. If you look at the counts that they're asking you to add well-built holding, why they want to add well-built holding here is a question I didn't understand. There's a $55 million letter of credit posted for backing up this judgment. They're asking you to have direct the district court and the bankruptcy court to enter a finding on count 10, breach of fiduciary duty. The breach of fiduciary duty, no one has been found guilty of breach of fiduciary duty. So they want you to deny well-built holding, its right to a jury trial on the breach of fiduciary duty count, and enter a judgment on count 10 when nobody, not a notice, not any of the directors, has been found guilty of breach of fiduciary duty. Unless the court has any questions, allow Mr. Baton to use his time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. It's my privilege to represent those appellees that are natural persons, Messrs. Antonini, Yee, Hirsch, and Gross. Messrs. Antonini and Yee were on the board of Consolidated in 1994 when, contrary to predictions, Consolidated's net sales dropped from $30.6 million to $23.5 million. That resulted in an inability of Consolidated to pay all of the interest on the dividend notes, and in due course it was accrued in the intercompany account. All of the claims against Mr. Antonini and Mr. Yee were resolved in their favor in the bankruptcy court. They were resolved in their favor in the district court, and I respectfully submit that this court should affirm the final judgment dismissing them, these two individuals, from this case for all times. That then brings me to my other three clients, Mr. Hirsch, Mr. Hirsch, and Mr. Gross. They were the people who adopted the dividend notes. They were the people who tried to push down to save state and local taxes the interest earned on the paid on the LBO debt. That was real interest, and while a notice could receive the tax credit at the federal level because it filed a consolidated return, if it didn't push the debt down to the subsidiaries, that deduction was lost, and therefore the taxes of Consolidated and other subsidiaries like it, state taxes, would go up. So that, of course, is the theory of the dividend notes, and Mr. Hirsch, and Mr. Gross, with the advice of accountants and lawyers, signed them. Now, on September 6th of 2000, they were removed as officers of a notice corporation, and shortly following that meeting, they were removed as directors of Consolidated. Ms. Steggy argues in her brief that the adverse domination doctrine should apply to them and the claim should have been told. As of last afternoon, no court in Indiana has yet addressed the adverse domination doctrine. I think the lower courts were correct to assume that when confronted with that issue, the Indiana courts will adopt it. There is no law cited by Ms. Steggy that suggests that the Indiana courts will do what no other court has ever done, and that is say that an executive who serves as a director of a wholly owned subsidiary leaves the subsidiary. The subsidiary no longer controls the subsidiary. The subsidiary has every incentive to sue him or her if they've done something wrong. Doesn't matter as long as the subsidiary remains a wholly owned subsidiary. There are obviously lots of companies in this country that have owned subsidiaries for 50 or 100 years. Does that mean that the period of limitations against all their executives are told? So I believe respectfully that the judgment in favor of the other three individuals, Messrs. Hirsch, and Gross, should likewise be affirmed.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.